Welcome everybody to our Holding the Line Q&A with Greg Felton. The reason I thought it'd be interesting to chat with Greg is he's done two very, I think, important things. One is he published what I believe was the first book in the world, in English anyway, to pin down the SARS-CoV-2 as some kind of human-engineered virus, which is quite a good job to have done. In his book, SARS-CoV-2, Contagion, Collusion, Corruption. I think that's right, Greg, isn't it?
That's correct. It's,
and,
it's available from TurningTheTidePublishing.com in Florida.
Yeah, and a terrific book it is too. I mean, it's really picking apart some of the science and trying to explain it for anybody that's interested in the actual scientific evidence behind all this. The other reason is because of Greg's other book, which is about the Middle East, and it looks at the whole situation in the Middle East as, you know, something where I have, you know, a great deal of sympathy towards the Palestinian cause, and the way that the media in the West seems to, and of course the very strong Israel lobby seems to turn this away from looking at it dispassionately, both sides of this conflict, and turn it into, you know, basically an anti-Arab rant. But anyway, do you want to just remind me of the title of the other book, Greg?
Yeah, it's called The Host and the Parasite, How Israel's Fifth Column Consumed America.
And also, of course, I don't know about of course, but we might get into in the Q&A or even in later as Greg talks to us, and he's going to have something like 30 to 40 minutes to talk about those two. Basically, the firstly, I think, is the we're going to look at the book, the SARS-CoV-2 book, and then if people have got really what they think are really important pressing questions rather than statements, please do feel free to interrupt Greg and then at the end, please do scribble down notes of questions, and we'll have a decent long 30-minute Q&A at the end. Greg Felton, I'll just hand over to you for roughly 30 minutes to just talk about, first of all, your book on SARS-CoV-2, Contagion, Collusion, Corruption, and then maybe to go on to the wider conflicts, possibly the Middle East and in Ukraine.
Well, yeah, the Ukraine. I was going to start with the Ukraine and Russia, and then go into the SARS too. But I can do it in reverse order. That's not a problem.
I just think, yeah, from chronologically, you know, COVID happened before the Ukraine thing really kicked off in February this year, and so it'd be, I think, more helpful to do it in, like, chronologically, if you don't mind.
Well, that is true, technically speaking, but really the origin of the Ukraine in debacle began in the early 1990s.
Yeah,
I mean, this is when it really started. But yeah, we'll start with the the SARS-2 book. The one thing I found particularly
sorry,
bizarre.
Greg, can you just do a little introduction of yourself
and
give us a bit about your background? Yeah.
Okay. My name is Greg Felton. I was a journalist from about 1993 until about 2003 or so, roughly. I have a master's degree in political science from UBC and a bachelor's degree in Russian studies. I lived in Moscow in 1979 during the Chinese invasion of Vietnam, and it was during the Brezhnev period as well, so I saw what life was like behind the Iron Curtain. I've lived virtually all my life in the Lower Mainland. Currently, I teach American history and high-level English to either adults or high school students going into university. I don't know quite what else to say about myself of relevance. I have been a journalist, as I say, since about 1993, and I still consider myself a writer primarily, even though I don't make really any money from it. My day job is teaching, so that's how I support my writing habit. What if my voice seems a little croaky, it means I've been on a bit of medication. So I want to talk a little bit about the SARS-2 virus, because that and the Ukraine debacle in Europe have one very interesting common feature. They are both subject to heavy censorship by the people who are interested in propounding the official narrative of what's happening. The SARS-2 virus is one of the most badly executed frauds, I think, in the history of mankind. It was badly executed, but so ruthlessly prosecuted that the fraud has been accepted to a large extent as the official version. Those who challenge it are vigorously persecuted. As a matter of fact, in Australia, any doctor who challenges the need or the healthfulness of these vaccines, and I use the term loosely, can lose his job. The government has bullied the entire medical community into acquiescence to having their patients get these Pfizer or Moderna or AstraZeneca injections. Even though the Centers for Disease Control has admitted that they're not vaccines, that they do not provide immunity, and that Pfizer has never said they provide immunity. The Centers for Disease Control has admitted that the PCR tests that people have to go to determine whether or not they have the virus is useless, because a PCR test cannot indicate contagiousness, and it cannot determine the viral load, that is to say, how severely one is affected. Now, you know people who've got common colds. Some of them get a bit of the sniffles, but they still function pretty well. And some of them get so severely hit by the bug that they have to stay in bed. Now, the person who has to stay in bed has a higher viral load, and that's all it means. But the most disturbing thing about the SARS-2 virus is why so much censorship was needed. I mean, why have people not been told the full story, or at least both sides of what the virus is, or about the health factors for and against of getting injections or of wearing face masks? As soon as the virus came out, almost, it seems the narrative spin doctors went into overdrive to take charge of the event, to control what the people knew. The idea of a vaccine, so-called, for this virus was in the works long before we ever heard of SARS-2, long before we ever heard of COVID-19, which, by the way, is not a virus. It's a vascular disease associated with getting the SARS-2 virus, but it doesn't affect everyone. I mean, many people who get the SARS-2 virus show no symptoms at all. But the fact that COVID-19 is such a horrible disease, it does take, you know, people can recover from it, but it does have a death toll. It has somehow replaced SARS-CoV-2 as the name of the virus. So there's been a nomenclature corruption that even professional doctors are using. The media, of course, is a mouthpiece for the official narrative, so it also parrots this abuse of language. But what concerns me is why this virus came about in the first place. And what is unalterably clear is that the United States and China were both heavily involved in manufacturing this disease. In fact, funding had gone to the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill to the laboratory of Ralph Baric, who was doing experimental research on developing a coronavirus that was particularly lethal to humans. Now, you might ask yourself why anybody would want to do that. And you'd be right to do so. But the standard excuse given was that, well, you know, if we can manufacture such a deadly virus that we can create a vaccine to protect, to create a vaccine to fight it, why, we can protect people so easily. But that kind of feels like a self-fulfilling prophecy. I mean, if you invent a toxic virus and it ends up killing people, well, then you're essentially doing, you're wasting your own time. Why invent a drug that's so deadly just to create a vaccine and then risk people dying from it anyway? And so this is what happened during the night during 2019 and 2020, when the Wuhan laboratory, the Wuhan Level 4 laboratory in China, was trying to manufacture the virus that's now known as SARS-CoV-2. This was done under the name of what is called gain of function research. Now, that's a horrible euphemism that describes how you can take a virus and make it even more virulent. And this was done allegedly using bats, although it's unclear that bats were at all responsible for the spread of the disease. So we ended up with this leak, so-called, from the Wuhan laboratory in, the first time we heard of it was in December 2019, but I have evidence that there was something as far back as October of that year, and possibly even earlier from Wuhan, but no one said or did anything about it. Now, the one thing the Chinese did, which was kind of bizarre, is that it manufactured an argument that said this virus came out of nature. And yet there is no evidence to support it. And on February the 3rd, 2020, Nature Journal published an article spearheaded by Shizheng Li, who is the bat woman of China, the most experienced and knowledgeable scientist about coronavirus. Well, that particular article was a colossal fraud. It was a deliberate fraud that tried to claim that there was a common ancestor between the SARS virus and the SARS-CoV-2 virus, and that this was found as some sort of rat fecal sample called RATG13. This never existed. It was an entirely fabricated piece of evidence that, in fact, was based on a pre-existing sample that was under refrigeration in the Wuhan laboratory. What happened was there was a massive attempt to backdate the common ancestor of SARS-CoV-2 to before 2016. And that way they could show that, oh, this has been out in the wild for a long time. And boy, we're sure lucky we found it. So now we can develop a vaccine for it. Well, that can't happen because the progeny, the origin of the virus was in a laboratory. So even if you believe that this was a natural virus, the etiology of the virus, its origin, does not match the real virus. So any vaccine you would have created based upon a natural theory would have been useless. And in fact, it is useless. In fact, none of these vaccines that people are being given is by definition a vaccine. They are not meant to be vaccines. They were never meant to be vaccines. They were meant to be gene therapies to fight cancer. And Robert Malone, one of the inventors of the mRNA vaccine, which is what people are getting, admitted that people should not be getting them. They're dangerous. And the death toll from this vaccine is orders of magnitude beyond anything for any other vaccine that has been administered to the human race. So what we have here is a manufactured virus, a controlled narrative to lie not only about the origin of the virus, but about the efficacy of these injections and wearing masks. Now, the World Health Organization is up to its ears in collusion with the Chinese, as is the Centers for Disease Control and the Food and Drug Administration, not to mention the National Institutes of Health, where Anthony Fauci has his office. So the question is, why would these people collude in lying about the efficacy of a treatment and forcing people, even against their will, to get one of these injections, which is contrary to the Nuremberg statutes that came out of World War II, which said that no person should be coerced against his or her will to be a subject in a medical experiment, which is what really these vaccines are. They are medical experiments where people are guinea pigs. They are not told what the risks are. They are not told what's in these vaccines. They are not told why they're getting them. They are not given enough information to give informed consent. And that's the one thing that is missing throughout all of this. And yet so many people acquiesced to it. So many people got these drugs, thought they were doing the right thing, felt they had no choice. And now we have millions upon billions of people walking around with these drugs in their bodies that, for all we know, could end up killing them at some time in the distant future or even the near future. We already know that these drugs cause serious heart problems, and that footballers such as Kun Aguero, who played for Manchester City, had to retire because he got one of these injections and his heart wouldn't let him play football. Children are getting these drugs and they're having heart problems. Women are having menstrual problems because of these drugs. And yet no one ever explained to them what could happen. Very interestingly, in November of last year, a man named Stefan Olrich, who's the director of pharmaceuticals for Bayer, got up at the World Health Forum and gave the inaugural address, in which he said, and I'm going to paraphrase, "We are lucky that we came out with these injections when we did." It's also quite interesting that the idea of them being called a vaccine was a marketing ploy to convince people to get these drugs. Because had we told them the truth, that they were experimental gene therapies, we would have had a 95% refusal rate. I have that on video. It cannot be denied. And yet the internet is full of these pseudo fact checkers that are trying to say that he never said it or that his words were misconstrued. There is a massive attempt to backpedal, to walk back Ulrich's inappropriate, although candid and honest admission. So the question we need to ask ourselves is why the hell anybody gave these drugs to people? And this is where it gets a bit interesting because we don't have any real hard and fast evidence. We have a lot of very convincing circumstantial evidence to say it was a bioweapon that was going to be used against China or the United States. We have evidence to suggest that it was designed to literally to kill people to lower the world's population because there are too many people in the world. This is what is being heralded as the Great Reset, to remove the surplus population and to transfer billions upon trillions of dollars of wealth from the lower and middle classes to the highest income classes, the very people who need money the least. And this is one of the things that is a little hard for people to get their head around, and I don't blame them. How can you have an organization deliberately killing people, deliberately impoverishing the world, just so billionaires can have more money in their pockets? It's worth investigating because we don't know what goes on behind closed doors. Our elected politicians really are not competent to legislate on our behalf. They are essentially instruments of other unelected agencies, like the World Economic Forum. And these are the people that are really pushing this agenda called the Great Reset. But the interesting thing is, it's better not to start from a presumption than try to find the evidence. Look at the evidence and try to figure out why it would happen. And the only thing you can come up with, really, is that there is no defense for either the SARS-2 virus being invented, There is no defense for these injections and this mask wearing, which was never proven to be effective. In fact, no evidence suggests that wearing a face mask will protect you. And yet people have lost their jobs. They have been bullied, intimidated, insulted if they don't wear a face mask. Because the virus itself is less than 0.3 micron in diameter. And for anybody who knows physics, anything smaller than 0.3 micron does not obey a vector motion. It cannot go in a straight line. It obeys what's called Brownian motion. And it behaves a bit like a pinball in a machine that it impinges. Sorry for my camera here. I've got to step this up. It essentially bounces off other molecules and it gives and it transfers momentum. It has no ability to generate momentum of its own. It simply gives and takes being bounced around. And so when people say you need a mask, it's not true. Because even if somebody had the virus, they wouldn't be able to give it to somebody because you cannot get the virus from talking to someone. And that's, you know, look it up if you don't believe me. But again, looking up information is a little bit dangerous because if in a world where stupidity is considered patriotism, it is very dangerous to be intelligent. And that's a quote from Isaac Asimov. And so we have a world where we're being deliberately lied to about something very important for public health. And in a similar way, we're being lied to about what's going on in Ukraine. And I'll just take a few minutes to summarize why this is the case. At the end of the 1980s, early 1990s, when the Soviet Union disbanded, then Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev was convinced to disband the Warsaw Pact, which was founded in 1953 to counter NATO, which was founded in 1947. Gorbachev did so willingly under the expectation that NATO would similarly disband, because frankly, it had no reason to exist. It had become an anachronism. But NATO didn't disband. It expanded. And despite repeated promises to Russia that the United States would not expand NATO 1 inch to the east. Now that promise was made 3 times to the Russian government in the early 1990s by James A. Baker III, who was a representative of President H.W. Bush. Now the Russians believed it. I mean, they didn't have much choice. But since then, more than, I think it's about 12.5 countries have been added. Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, Croatia, Slovenia, Slovakia, Bulgaria, Montenegro, Northern Macedonia. And with each of these, Russia became progressively more and more angry, resentful, and disgusted with the United States. It realized it could not trust the United States to keep its word. And in fact, that's a lesson a lot of countries have learned. But what made this particularly dangerous is that in 2008, at the Bucharest summit, George H.W. Bush's stupid, alcoholic, Bible-thumping kid, decided he was going to invite or accept as for membership Georgia and Ukraine. Now, Georgia's in the Caucasus Mountains, about as far from the North Atlantic as any possible applicant could be. Why it deserves to be in NATO is anybody's guess. As for Ukraine, well, that's the big problem. Now, Russia was prepared to ignore Latvia, Estonia, Lithuania, Poland, because these are not particularly big countries, especially the three Baltic states. I mean, it was symbolic, but it was a nuisance, but that was all. Ukraine is the largest country wholly within the European continent. It is a significant source of grain for much of the world, particularly Africa. So when Ukraine is being suggested for membership in NATO, this is something that directly affects the national interests and security of Russia. And that was made unalterably clear in 2008 when Bush made his invitation, said, told Russia it would accept membership from Ukraine and Georgia. So we can date the current debacle at least to 2008 when this started. So the Ukrainian government at the time was led by Viktor Yanukovych, a generally eastern-looking pro-Russian president who was duly elected by the Ukrainian public. In 2013, well, actually, between 2008 and 2014, the European Union and the United States tried to inveigle Ukraine into joining the European Union. They did so because they knew that if Ukraine joined, it meant that Europe, Western Europe, NATO countries would be on the border of Russia. Now, the Russians would never tolerate this. And in fact, many European leaders at the time understood Russia's need for security and would never have countenanced a Ukrainian membership. But something happened between then and 2014. See, in the intervening period, the European Union tried to bring Ukraine into the common market. And Yanukovych initially was quite receptive to this. And he thought, well, sure, why not? Vladimir Putin got on the horn to Yanukovych and said, look, I'm going to get you to change your mind. I don't want you joining Western Europe. Eventually, Yanukovych in November 2013 did change his mind. And that infuriated the United States and NATO. There were a lot of riots and unrest called the Maidan Revolution, like one of these color revolutions, that was entirely stage managed by the United States. In fact, in February of that next year, Viktor Yanukovych would flee the country because a coup d'etat had been effected by the United States. And in his place was put in power Pyotr Poroshenko, who was a neo-Nazi fascist who would do America's bidding. And one of the first things he did was to repeal the minority language laws that gave Russians equal standing with Ukrainian. So Yanukovych flees the country, and Victoria Nuland, whose real name is Noodleman, that she changed to sound less Jewish, boasted that the United States spent $6 billion to get rid of Yanukovych. She admitted that the United States staged a coup d'etat. And our problems in Ukraine really stem from that one seminal moment. Now, Poroshenko was replaced later by Volodymyr Zelensky, a professional entertainment clown who changed careers to become a political clown and allowed himself to be manipulated and bamboozled and flattered by the United States and NATO. You see, Zelensky did not know his place. He did not know what his job is. As a buffer state between Russia and NATO, Ukraine cannot afford to alienate either side. It has to play a very delicate balancing act. And if it had it done so, we would not be in the position we are today. It was Zelensky's cozying up to NATO, even though he's not in NATO yet, that essentially convinced Putin that he had no choice but to send the troops over the border to prevent NATO from establishing missile bases and other emplacements on his border, something that Russia had warned the United States about in 2008. It would not countenance a Western-allied Ukraine on its border. And so this is where we are today. The United States really is not interested in Ukrainian democracy, which doesn't exist. It is not interested in helping the poor Ukrainian people. Ukraine is irrelevant to this entire debacle. The actual shooting war is a sideshow. The only thing that is going on here is a calculated policy of weakening and ostracizing Russia. Not because it poses a great threat to anybody, but because there are people in the American government, the same people who brought you the World Trade Center implosion, the Iraq invasion, and countless other acts of aggression. These people want a unipolar world with the United States as the world hegemon. Russia represents a threat to absolute American power, as does China. Russia is also generally not liked by Israel, because Russia has in the past supported Syria and Iran and other Arab countries against Israel-American aggression. So the United States, which is really run by the unipolarists, like essentially the Israel lobby, these people are trying to push Russia to the brink of bankruptcy and to destabilize it. Now, the queer thing is here, you see, there are plenty of people in America who know this is dangerous and stupid. Professor John Mearsheimer of Harvard gave a wonderful lecture in which he completely destroyed the credibility of trying to beggar Russia. George F. Kennan, who's the father of containment, and the NSC 68 document of the Truman administration, who gave us our containment policy of Russia, which became national policy, I guess, for the rest of the 20th century. He said this was a ridiculous policy that is nothing, going to do nothing more than inflame Russia and provoke a reaction. The same was said by Robert Gates, the former national security advisor. And even more criminal, Henry Kissinger, of all people, came out opposed to this provocation of Russia. It seems that there's a bit of a dichotomy in the American between the pro-Americans who don't want to antagonize Russia and the unipolarists who do. And the one thing the unipolarists have in common is that they're all Zionist Jews, or they are sympathetic to Israel and are Zionist Christians. The upshot is that the Zionist influence in the United States is pushing or is responsible for the Russia-Ukrainian aggression. Now, one could argue that Putin overreacted and should not have invaded Ukraine. There's a case to be made for that, I think. But if you go back to 1979, and you study what happened between the Soviet Union and Afghanistan, you can appreciate the Russian mentality. I mean, for all of its size, the Russian mentality has always been very insecure. When a coup d'etat was staged in Afghanistan in 1979, and the sadistic doctrinaire Marxist Hafizullah Amin overthrew the moderate government of Mohammad al-Taraki, the Muslims in northern Afghanistan became extremely agitated and restive. They started rioting against the government because they would not put up with the repressive anti-Muslim, pro-communist doctrinaire militarism that Amin was imposing on it. Now, for Leonid Brezhnev, this was a problem. Either he could do nothing, hope it went away, or he could go in to remove Hafizullah Amin with the Red Army and prevent the unrest from spilling over into the Soviet Union, which at the time had five Muslim republics in Central Asia. Brezhnev did not want to invade. He had better things to do, and he knew it was a risky venture. In fact, no European country in Afghanistan has come out with a victor. The British learned that the hard way in the 19th century. So when push came to shove, Brezhnev decided invasion was the lesser of two evils. And it did. And that meant that Russia had committed itself to a war it likely could not win. In the United States, the government of Jimmy Carter, under the influence of National Security Advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was a dyed-in-the-wool Russophobe, convinced Carter to give money to the resistance movement in Afghanistan, which at the time also consisted of a lot of Arabs from Saudi Arabia, led by an inexperienced son of a son of a father who had a construction company, and that son was Osama bin Laden. Money was thrown into Afghanistan to create a Vietnam for Russia, to immerse Russia in a war it couldn't win, to weaken it such that the United States would come out relatively stronger. There is a very strong parallel between that and what is going on today in Ukraine. The United States cares nothing about Ukraine. It just wants to weaken and ostracize Russia. And if you've seen the clip of American Congressman Lindsey Graham, along with John McCain and one other person in Ukraine, this was openly admitted in 2016 when Lindsey Graham told the Ukrainians, "Your battle is our battle," or "Your war is our war," or words to that effect, and that the main objective is to weaken Russia. Now, why would he say that in 2016, 6 years before Russia crossed the border? You see, this whole Ukraine scenario was in the works for a very long time. And the visual effects of it, the violence, is like the proverbial tip of the iceberg. What you don't see below the surface is what is really responsible. And the same people who brought us the Ukraine war is the same people who brought us the World Trade Center. So right now, both the Ukraine-Russia debacle and the SARS-CoV-2 debacle are being brought to you by, well, the American government. Big pharma, big Israel, big armaments, essentially designed for no other reason to make money for drug companies and to enhance American hegemony around the world. As a teacher of American history, I can tell you that Americans are pretty good at winning wars, so-called, but they are horrible and incompetent at winning peace. The United States has never been more aggressive or violent or self-righteous as when there was no shooting war and they had to deal with a status quo that was different from what it was before the war. So we are actually in a world where nobody should trust anything they see on the media. Nobody should trust anything they read or see, but they should try to find out their own information. And that becomes very difficult. Because whom do you trust? You can't trust the BBC or Google or MSNBC. There is now what's called the Trusted News Initiative, which is a horribly Orwellian expression for saying, this is the official propaganda we're going to force feed you for your own good. And we're going to protect you from discordant critical thought that might get you thinking that maybe what you're being told isn't the whole truth. The BBC is a toxic organization. The British Bullshit Corporation is what I call it. It's so heavily owned by Israel that it's and corporate interests that it's almost risible as a news source. And yet when you hear things like the Trusted News Initiative, doesn't that make you feel all warm and cozy inside? Oh, it's trusted, and I know the BBC. It has a great history of honesty, and it gave us Monty Python. So, or was that the Independent, or was that Channel 4? I'm not sure. So you have to see people that, organizations that rely on their reputation to hoodwink people into trusting them. These are the greatest threats to democracy. Because once you convince people there is no threat, they will accept anything. And the gormless masses of the world are walking around wearing face masks, getting their injections and their umpteenth booster shot, and thinking that Russia is the villain in the European war, or European conflict. The gormless masses will believe anything when they're not given the full story. Because under conditions of uncertainty, we have no way to form a complete rational theory of what's going on. So we have to fill in the gaps as best we can. And only a handful of us have the time or the inclination or the desire, inclination or the intelligence to ferret out the real information from the propaganda. So right now we are living in most dangerous times, and those people who know what's going on are what I think Orwell called dangerous men. Anyway, that's what I got to say.
Before we go to questions, the obvious thing to ask is where you think this is heading, because you're painting a picture there. I think, when you talk about the gormless masses, this is, I remember a phrase from a guy I used to interview before he died last year, Manfred Petrisch, who's a German. He'd worked in finance in Switzerland and moved to Abkhazia. And he said, well, don't be fooled by the propaganda, because this stuff is just for the stupid people. The fact is that there are a lot of people out there who do look more and more increasingly critically at the mass media and don't believe a word they're told. But anyway, look, what about where all this is heading, particularly with the potential for bio warfare, and also, of course, with this war now going on in Europe and increasing tensions in the Middle East between Iran and Israel.
Well, first of all, the source you cited is quite correct. A lot of people are not buying the propaganda, but there are sufficient numbers of those who do that keep it alive and keep the pot stirring, such that it's very difficult to separate wheat from chaff. But I am gratified to see that more people are dissenting from the official narrative, and that more than 50% of the people I see now are not wearing masks. And this was when the provincial government here repealed the mask edict. There were only negligible people walking around, what I call free face folk. But now, people have come to realize that they're just not any use, and they're stopping wearing them, which is encouraging. Now, as far as the Ukraine debacle goes, I think ultimately Russia is going to win this. And that may seem like a very odd thing to say right now, but you have to look at the long-term ramifications of it. Europe has been coerced into abandoning economic ties with Russia, and that means oil and gas. In place of rather inexpensive, high-quality Russian oil and gas, Europe is being forced to accept tankers of American oil and gas, which are more expensive and of lower quality. How long are the European peoples going to allow themselves to be abused like this? How long are they going to put up with having to pay for more expensive fuel just because their governments are bullied by the United States into ostracizing Russia? When's it going to stop? Russia can hold on for quite some time. It's not a weak system, not a weak country. And the more that the corruption of NATO becomes publicized, to the extent it can be publicized, the less credibility the official narrative will have. I mean, remember, the United States right now is a dying empire. It has been hollowed out by Israel to the point where it's a mere husk of a democracy. There are no politicians in the United States. There are only front men for corporations in Israel. And the American public is so disgusted with its government that it elected an amateurish buffoon to become president in 2016. I mean, Trump did not win that election. Hillary Clinton lost it. And that's the one thing a lot of people don't appreciate. The American public is gradually realizing that they're being lied to. And eventually, we're going to have some government get to power who realizes it's not in the United States' best interest to make an enemy of Russia.
Greg, can I just ask you to address this business of, you know, the tension between the US and China, with Russia kind of sandwiched in the middle?
Yeah, the thing is, Russia and China both represent threats to American hegemony, particularly economic hegemony. And the United States knows that it's losing ground to China because as an economic power, China is growing. America is barely growing. And the trade surplus with China benefits China to a great deal. So the United States wants to ensure that it doesn't end up in second place. So really, it's picking a fight with China because, well, it can. And so what the United States is doing, really, again, this is something that Napoleon and Hitler both failed to appreciate. You can't fight a two-front war and expect to win. The fact is, America has no sense of proportion. It has no sense of responsibility. It's an arrogant little 10-year-old boy who thinks it can get whatever it wants if it throws a big enough tantrum. It's provoking China because it wants to weaken China the same way it wants to weaken Russia. And it sees any collaboration between China and Russia as detrimental to American imperial hegemony. I read somewhere recently that North Korea was going to send troops to Ukraine to support Russia. And I thought, what an interesting scenario that would be. North Korea and Russia fighting in Ukraine against NATO.
Potential Third World War breaking out in Eastern Europe. Anyway, thanks ever so much, Greg, for your presentation there. I think probably the easiest way to deal with questions is if people put their hands up, or if your camera is off, maybe just switch your microphone on, and then we can see that you've got something to say. So, would anyone like to kick off with a question for Greg? Okay. HTL, go for it.
Yeah, Chris.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks, Greg. really interested to hear you. Comments that you made about the intention of pushing Russia to the brink of bankruptcy clearly, you know, has failed. And in terms of the sanctions, which it's hard to imagine that the architects of the sanction program really believed that they would have the effect that ostensibly they set out to have, because actually it's really had a reverse effect, hasn't it? It's just deepened the immiseration of Western Europeans primarily. You know, think of they're actually talking opening Germany about the pretty much their industrial economy just grinding to a complete halt by the winter, and you know, and all the crises, the engineered crises, clearly that are taking place in most European countries, UK certainly. And really, it seems that far from the intention of being weakening Russia, it's almost as if the purpose of those sanctions was to actually create further chaos and crises in the West. I just wondered what your thoughts are on that, because that's clearly what's happening. And it just relies on us thinking that they, in some way, thought that sanction program was going to have the outcome that they ostensibly ascribed to it. But,
well, you know,
they're evil, but they're not stupid. You know what I mean?
No, you're quite right about that. As a matter of fact, that has a lot to do with the general thinking of the United States. Remember, Israel is really in charge of U.S. military and foreign policy. And what is done not because it's rational, or defensible, or even in the American interest. It's in the interest of a cabal of usurpers of the American government, the same people that came to power in 2000, the project for the new American century. I'm quite sure that Russia can wait this out for a long time. And you're quite right. The industrial plant of Europe could grind to a halt. Germany, France, I don't know, maybe Poland, Czech Republic, they may be forced to go back to Russia. But rational thinking does not play into this. The unipolarists are driven by almost, you know, a self-righteous moralism that they have some, what they want is what they can get. But they don't realize that, you know, just because they want to weaken Russia, that they can do it. No real thought went into this. This is just atavistic, arrogant, imperial overreach. It's like what happened to the Greeks after the Persian Wars in 478 BCE. After the Persians were defeated, the alliance of the Greek city-states and islands was perpetuated by Athens, and it became known as the Delian League, centered around the island of Delos. And although this mutual defense pact did manage to work in some minor skirmishes after the shooting had ended, it turned into not so much a defense alliance, but an Athenian empire, where people were, or islands and city-states were coerced into giving tribute to Iran, to Athens, because they had grown so used to it during the wars. And those who didn't want to join were murdered, as what happened to the people on the island of Milos. The women and children were taken as slaves, and the male population were slaughtered. I mean, Athens became an arrogant, self-righteous, intolerant hegemon, and that would ultimately lead to the Peloponnesian Wars. And so the United States is behaving just like Athens. It has an anachronistic military alliance, and it's going to essentially alienate its own allies and bring about its own ruination. NATO must be disbanded as soon as possible. It serves no function. And the fact that people are doing this, they're almost driving NATO off the edge of a cliff. But nobody cares because there's no rational thought behind it. The same sort of Zionists who ran the World Trade Center attack and the ridiculous invasion of Iraq are the same people who are driving the Ukrainian-Russian conflict. Now, you can't always see Israel behind the scenes, but the United States cannot have a foreign policy that in any way challenges Israel's self-interest. So you have to assume that Israel is behind this. And Israel is using a foreign government for its own interests, so it doesn't have to worry about reason, logic, or whether it's in the American national interest. America is an instrument. It's a means to an end, just as Ukraine is a means to an end.
Interesting, you're putting Israel in the center of all. Are you happy with the with that answer, Chris? You got any more, any supplemental question?
I've got one I'd like to ask him, but I don't want to monopolise, so if anybody else wants to dip in first.
Yeah, okay. I'd also point out the economist Michael Hudson, in a talk he gave recently, was discussing this whole thing of, well, you know, these empires, when they go down, what they start to do is, you know, rather than deal with the criticism, they start to assassinate their critics. And that's, you know, maybe, you know, of use here. But anyway, anyone else, put your hand up if you've got a question for Greg, please.
Oh, there's Anand's got a question.
Nobody? Ah, is that Gina? Is that your hand up? No? No.
There's Anonymous up in the left-hand corner there.
Anonymous put a question in the chat.
Yes, I just got that. I'm just having a quick look at it.
Okay.
Do I have any thoughts on why Russia went along with the COVID narrative regarding lockdowns, injections, and injection passports?
Yeah, good question.
I don't know if I have an answer to that, but I think you can, if you look at this as a steamroller, once the narrative was started, and the myth of these injections became accepted as conventional wisdom, I think people took it at face value. And I think that the Russians probably, like everybody else, realized that, wait a minute, maybe these vaccines are a good thing. Because I don't think there was any real investigation into the utter fraud behind them. Now, when I told you about Stefan Ulrich last November, that is something I only came upon, well, in the relatively recent past. Because once you hear the word vaccine, that essentially forces people to drop their guard. Vaccines are life-saving. I had my polio vaccine. I had my mumps, measles, rubella vaccine. My kids are immunized, so they're safe. Now, vaccines do immunize people. But the fact that the idea of a vaccine was a calculated lie convinced, nevertheless, essentially brainwashed people into thinking it was safe. And so once you start with a frame of reference that's corrupt, you behave in a way that frame of reference sets out. So it's understandable that Russia and other places would go along with the lockdown, the injections, and the so-called vaccine passports, which are grossly illegal. And yet, in a case of an emergency, standards of law and normal conduct are held in abeyance, and people behave differently. The same way that Abraham Lincoln suspended habeas corpus during the Civil War. Whether he should have done it is irrelevant. He did it, and no one could stop him. But the idea that once you have a frame of reference that's corrupt, and you behave within that frame of reference, then reason and logic are not applicable. It's once that frame of reference is challenged successfully that all hell breaks loose, which is why this trusted news initiative nonsense is being foisted on us. Google is doing its own news initiative. There's a massive campaign, a propaganda campaign, to keep control of the narrative. Because once that collapses, then a lot of people will be held accountable. And one of the reasons that the lie of SARS-CoV-2 being a natural virus persists is that once you stop believing it, then you have to ask, well, who did it? Why did people do it? Who's responsible? Who can be sued for this? And that's where you end up. So the lie is going to be perpetuated. It's going to be run down for as long as it can until it finally collapses.
Well, we've got a question from James, but I'm not sure what the question is. I don't know if anyone can help me out here.
I can ask it. Hello, can you hear me?
Oh, yeah, yep, okay. Yep.
Go ahead. Yep.
Hi, Greg. I was just wondering, I've not heard it mentioned tonight, but I was just wondering if you had anything to say, really, whether you thought the so-called climate crisis, how if that was integral to COVID-19 and also to the situation in Ukraine in some way.
Global warming, I wouldn't call it so-called. There is a climate crisis. I don't think that is in debate, in doubt. Here where I live in the southwestern part of British Columbia, we used to be called the Wet Coast, not the West Coast. But strictly, really, we're in a bit of a drought here. We have less rainfall than we used to get. And last year at this time, on my porch, the temperature hit 43 degrees. Now, that is something you might find in the Gobi Desert, the Mojave Desert, in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. 43 degrees in British Columbia. This was horrific. The entire town, the entire village of Lytton went up in flames. Now, there's no scenario that can explain this except man-made global warming. Now, as far as Ukraine goes and COVID-19 or the SARS-2 virus, I don't see any direct connection. I think what I do know is that before the pandemic was declared, I think it was June 2020, the company of Moderna, which is, by the way, in partnership with the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, was on the verge of bankruptcy. Poof, all of a sudden we have this pandemic. And because it was declared a pandemic by the Food and Drug Administration, it was possible for Pfizer, Moderna, AstraZeneca, and a bunch of other companies to put out experimental drugs without having to do proper safety checks. Had the pandemic not been declared, this could never have happened. And the only change between the pre-pandemic and now is that Big Pharma has made billions upon billions of dollars in windfall profits. It's worth looking at whether the entire pandemic was designed to be a cash grab by Big Pharma. Now, I'm not suggesting that SARS-2 doesn't exist, and I'm not suggesting that COVID-19 is not a serious byproduct of the SARS-2 virus, but I'm thinking perhaps that the magnitude of it was exaggerated. And the only real beneficiaries are the drug companies. So when you want to ask yourself who benefits from something, you follow the money.
Greg, on the back of that.
That's great. Thank you. Yeah.
Sorry, James. On the back of that, and to tie it back to what you're saying about 9/11, clearly there were a huge number of beneficiaries from the events of 9/11, and not least the military-industrial complex, American imperialism, massive commercial, financial, industrial interests. So do you think, going back to the lab leak hypothesis, was it a let it happen on purpose or make it happen on purpose leak, given the what you've just outlined by way of who benefits from this particular activity?
Well, I do touch on this in my book. It's impossible to say definitively because we don't have enough information. But if you look at the very ham-fisted, incompetent way that China tried to convince the world it was a naturally occurring virus, I have to think it was an accident. Now, perhaps there was a plan to release this virus sometime in the future, before it came out, but it might have leaked in advance unintentionally. The same way that the gas bomb that went off in Damascus in August 2013 went off prematurely. And that was something that Hillary Clinton and Saudi Arabia and Turkey were all involved with. So I would suggest that it was probably an accident, especially since, you know, the idea that the wet market in the Hainan wet market was the source of the virus, that argument was so transparently false that even a child wouldn't have come up with it. Because the first cases of the SARS-2 virus, which was early December 2019, occurred before the wet market was even involved. And no bats were sold in the wet market. So there is not an ounce of credibility to that argument. And yet, even to this day, it is still mentioned as the cause of the virus. So why would anybody be so incompetent as to manufacture something unless they had to do something quickly and they couldn't think of anything better to do? So I have a hard time believing that the virus was released deliberately when it was.
It's always easy with hindsight because, of course, SARS-CoV-2 was kind of undercover as the flu. A lot of people weren't sure what this was in the early stages. and that the October-November World Military Games in Wuhan seems to be one of the sources, with hindsight, where military personnel, who obviously as younger people, most of them fit and young, could deal easily with the virus, were then taking it back home and then possibly passing it on to other older military personnel. And it took a while for it, this to be identified as a specific problem. So it may have possibly come out then. I mean, I don't know if you dealt with that in the book, but that's certainly one of the ways. And maybe I can put that as a question to you, whether you think the World Military Games in Wuhan in October, November 2019 played a part in the initial unrealized distribution of the virus.
It could well have done so. I do know that there were two people working at the Wuhan laboratory. One was working on a master's grant, one was a postdoctorate grant. And these two people, 17 days apart, came down with what we think was the virus. The woman, the younger of the two, boarded a train out of Wuhan and traveled around South China infected with this virus. And that might have spread the virus as well. And that is in my book. So, you know, there's also the argument that the Americans brought it with them in the military games to spread throughout China. I don't know if this is true. I don't have any evidence to support it. It's an interesting theory, but I'm not prepared to endorse it until I find more information.
No, that's right. These things are theories. I could tell you as well, anecdotally, here in Somerset, chatting to people out for country walks in the spring of 2020, several people I spoke to, including me myself, believed that we caught it, you know, back in December 2019 when it wasn't supposed to exist. So I think that there's a whole kind of load of investigation that could go on into whether it was out there. But look, just as a specific point to you, maybe just rounding up here, Greg, you're pinning a lot of this on the Israel lobby, particularly the war in Europe, that sort of thing. And I think, you know, you need to really justify yourself. People might accuse you of just being anti the Israeli state, even anti-Semitic for saying that.
Can I just interject there, Tony? Roger's had his hand up for a while, so in case you haven't seen his yellow hand, don't forget to bring him in.
Well, do you want to give you a bit of time to think about that one? But Roger, sorry, I didn't see your hand there. Go for it, Roger.
That's right. Yeah, before I ask my question, can I say firstly, I thought it was a really excellent summary, Greg, of the COVID situation and Ukraine. So thank you for that. And I will be listening to the recording because I want to hear it again. Secondly, on what Tony just said about December 2019, yes, I also have that experience. In fact, I keep a diary from time to time, and on the 24th of December 2019, Christmas Eve, I actually wrote that strange things were happening to my taste buds. And then I got ill, quite ill, in January, February through to early March. So I've since met loads and loads of people who believe they had it in December, absolutely numerous people. My question, though, is something else that hasn't been mentioned, I don't think, is the 5G rollout, which is often linked with this whole bigger picture. Do you have anything to say about that?
I'm sorry, what rollout was that?
5G telephone.
5G.
Yeah, the frequency thing, you see.
Yeah, the 5G is very dangerous, and I'm kind of disappointed that a lot of the public is going along with it, because, well, gee, if it's faster, it has to be better. And the more technological, or the more electronically divorced we become from ourselves and from nature, the more we don't perceive the danger that electronics can do to us. I mean, how many billions of bees are dying because of the radiation in the air that affects their ability to navigate? I don't know about 5G. I have not investigated that. The military-industrial Zionist complex in America is kind of hard to separate. Now, to go back to Tony's question, how do I justify Israel being at the core of all this? And bearing in mind that anti-Semitism is a nonsense word, it's only used as a political brickbat to bludgeon people into submission when they start challenging Israel. It only dates to 1875 and was invented by a German bigot named Wilhelm Marr, a German journalist who wanted to demonize Jews as something other than a religious group. So I would say that you can assume Israel is behind a lot of things, because the United States cannot act against Israel's self-interest. This is what President George H.W. Bush realized to his detriment when he coerced Yitzhak Shamir to go to Madrid to negotiate a permanent settlement with Yasser Arafat. As a result of that, the Israel lobby took out a venomous, I would say treasonous, advertisement in the New York Times that supported Israel's self-interest over their own president. And yet nothing was done about it. For Israel, it's a little hard to see as being the major driving force of the Ukraine conflict. But if you understand that the unipolarists in the United States are all sympathetic to Israel and all belong to the project for a new American century, then it becomes a lot easier to accept as a frame of reference. Again, there's so much information that's kept from us that it's very hard to build a definitive argument. So I would say that given the scenario, given the frame of reference of the United States, the attack on Russia is driven by, I would say, largely economic and political objectives. But these are upheld by the same people who brought you the World Trade Center. So I would say it's a little difficult to prove, but it's a very good working assumption. And there's plenty of evidence to suggest that the United States is a wholly owned subsidiary of Israel.
I mean, anti-Semitism isn't a fiction, is it? Because the Jewish Congress in the United States actually organized a boycott of Nazi Germany in the 1930s because of the persecution of Jews by the Nazis, didn't they?
Well, actually, be careful here. You're right in one part. The American Jewish Committee did organize the boycott, and it was very successful. But the term anti-Semitism is a nonsense, because Semitism is not an ethnic descriptor. It has nothing to do with people. It's a linguistic term, and it has to do with the sound of Sim and Shem. These are two Hebrew letters. They look like W, and one has a dot on the left-hand side or the right-hand side. And that becomes Shim. So Semitism is a nonsense term. What you are referring to is anti-Jewishness. But the laziness of the most people is that anti-Semitism has been so narrowly associated with Israel that people forget that Arabic is also a Semitic language. And so really anti-Semitism is what Israel is perpetrating on Arabs.
Okay, so are you being anti-Jewish by trying to pin the Ukraine war on Israel?
No. I'm merely identifying the people who are doing it and where their political allegiance lies.
Okay, Greg, maybe you could just finish up by summarizing your, talk about your, you know, specific books and where people can get hold of them if they want to, because I think certainly for me your book on SARS-CoV-2 was a fascinating read.
Well, thank you very much. SARS-CoV-2 Contagion, Collusion, Corruption. It can be bought from turningthetidepublishing.com. The Host and the Parasite, How Israel's Fifth Column Consumed America, can be bought from moneytreepublishing.com. And my third book, Exploding Middle East Myths, which is a compendium of essays about Israel in movies, history, the media, as well as a few of my favorite satires and dialogues, is also available from moneytreepublishing.com.
thanks for joining us and answering so comprehensively all our questions. And also thanks, obviously, for your talk at the beginning.
You're welcome.